Welcome back to Red Eyes Radio, or maybe you're joining us for the first time. In any regard, a warm welcome. Please check out redeyescreations.com, the website, for more on what we do. I'm Henrik Paggen, and we are coming to you from Scandinavia. And this is radio going out worldwide over the internet. We focus on what we consider to be some of the most interesting and important topics. Today we're spending an hour with Paul Hellier, one of Canada's best known and probably most controversial politicians. Although Hellier is best known for the unification of the Canadian Armed Forces and for his 1968 chairmanship of the Task Force on Housing and Urban Development, he has maintained a lifelong interest in macroeconomics. Throughout the years, as a journalist and political commentator, he has continued to fight for economic reforms, and he has written several books on this subject. At 88, Hellier, the former Canadian cabinet minister, is still active as ever and engaged in a wide variety of world issues, the most urgent of which is the world monetary and financial systems. But Paul is also with us to discuss his thoughts on the conspiracy of the cabal, the shadow government, and black operations. We'll also briefly talk about his interest in the UFO phenomena. Paul covers the energy crisis, what new clean technologies would mean, and the new industry that can result from it. He also offers solutions that he claims would fix the economy. Welcome to the program, Paul. Red Eyes Radio is the name of it. Thank you for being here and taking the time, of course, to talking more with us here today. This is going to be interesting. So welcome, Paul.
I'm very pleased to be on your show.
Excellent. Now, I've briefly mentioned a few things about your background here, of course, but I think we should spend some more time on this because I think it's pretty interesting. You have a position as a former Canadian cabinet minister, a former minister of national defense. And I kind of, you know, it's always interesting to hear how you come from a position within government going over to, well, being interested in the UFO phenomena and everything that's considered to be kind of on the fringe, I would guess, today. So what's your story, Paul?
Well, it's a long story, and I'll try to boil it down to a few minutes, but I was in the forces during World War II, and I was a child of the Depression, and I was very concerned about the kind of poverty that I saw in that era. I had a cousin, for example, who later became the best man at my wedding, who was an insurance salesman, and he, when he wore through the bottoms of his shoes, he didn't have enough money to have them resoled. Or half-soled, he had to just put cardboard in them to keep the dampness out. And after you see this sort of thing, it has a real effect on your psyche and enters right into your soul. So after the war, I went to university and to get even with the Prime Minister for wasting a couple of years of my time. And economics was the subject that really interested me most. And I kept asking my professors if recessions and depressions were necessary, and they could never give me a straight answer. They would say, well, we've always had recessions and depressions. Read your economic history. But I wasn't really interested in the fact that there had been recessions and depressions. I wanted to know if they were necessary. So finally, I had to do my own research, and I came to the conclusion that they were not necessary, that they were monetary phenomena, and that there had never been a recession or depression that was essential, that was really endemic to what could have been. So I decided to make a brave effort to try to get into Parliament and do something about it. The incentive for that, because I was only 25 years old at the time, the incentive was the fact that all the economists were saying there was going to be a depression, underlying depression, in 1950. As we had in the 1930s. And I knew that wasn't necessary, so I thought I had to try and do something about it. So I made an effort, a very special effort, to get a nomination for the Liberal Party ran in a riding that had never been liberal before since Confederation, which is the only reason they would consider taking a 25-year-old who didn't know much about anything at the time. Mm. And lo and behold, with odds 15-1 against me on election day, I got elected. Well, then when I got to Ottawa, I learned the second lesson of politics. The first one had been how you go about getting a nomination, a party endorsement. And the second one was that just because you have your picture in the front page of the second section of the Toronto Star, the largest circulation newspaper in Canada, doesn't mean you're a somebody when you get to Ottawa. And you really can't influence a policy at all, let alone monetary policy and financial policy. But then something happened that was, I guess, unforeseen, and I talk about it with reverence because it was the outbreak of the Korean War. And, of course, the very bright people who are running our world can always find the money to fight wars when they can't find money to win the peace.
Isn't that interesting how that happens?
Their education for people.
Yeah.
So the depression that didn't that was supposed to happen in 1950 did not happen. And some of the pressure was taken off, at least for a few years, while I sort of matured in the political realm. And I was reelected in 1953. Interestingly enough, we just celebrated Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth's 60th anniversary, and my late wife and I had the pleasure of being in the Abbey when she was crowned 59 years ago. So we were very fortunate in that respect. And then a few years later, I was defeated in a Diefenbaker sweep here, got back in the following year in a by-election. They call them partial elections in the United States, and became a key member of the shadow government, as they call it, on the opposition side. And then when the Pearson government was formed in 1963, I was given the prestigious portfolio of defense because I had before or a few years earlier served as parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Defense and then briefly as associate minister in the government of Louis Saint-Laurent just before the election in 1957.
Now, how do we move from this over to the area of ufology and things? I mean, you mentioned the shadow government, and this is obviously a very different type of shadow government that I guess you've learned about consequently. So tell us a little bit when you became aware of some of these more fringe areas, if I can put it that way, Paul.
Well, that came much later. When I was Minister of Defense, I did something that no other minister has ever done. I unified the Army, Navy, and Air Force into a single Canadian Defense Force. And consequently, my total energy was taken up by that because it was sort of a total war. The personnel in the armed forces were about equally divided, 50-50, in favor and against. But I had the tenacity and both the moral and physical strength to see it through to completion. And that was a considered a very major achievement, and I certainly consider it so, even though a lot of it has been reversed in subsequent years. But at the time, I was given reports of UFO sightings, but really didn't have time to look at them. And all they said was, that some of them had been identified as natural phenomena of a half a dozen different sorts. Some of them were planets and some were meteors and some were all sorts of things. But there were about roughly 20% that were unknown. And I, of course, was not sufficiently interested at the time to really ask the kind of questions that I would certainly ask today.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years after that, and even after I had left politics, I was not particularly interested in the subject. I was an agnostic. I didn't say that they didn't exist, and I didn't say that they did because I didn't know. So I just told the truth and said they certainly could exist, and but I'm not in a position to say. And that was really the situation that extended for, oh, many years until, I don't know, about roughly 10 years ago, when a young man in Ottawa by the name of Pierre Junot, started sending me information about UFOs. And I told him honestly that I didn't have time to read them. I try to be honest with people, and I just wrote him back and said, thanks a lot, but these will be neatly piled on the corner of my desk or in a file somewhere until I have time to read them if I ever do. But he didn't give up on me. He just kept sending things, and one of the things he sent was a book. It was called The Day After Roswell by Colonel Philip Korsel.
Yeah.
And when I picked it up or opened the package, I thought, well, that looks like an interesting read. Maybe I'll take a look at that sometime in the summer on my holiday, because that's about the only time that I have discretionary time off for reading. And so the next summer I looked for it and couldn't find it. I think the summer after that, I was looking for something else and couldn't find it. And there, staring me in the face, was The Day After Roswell by Korsel. So I took it with me on my holiday. I go to a place north of Toronto called the Lake Area, the Muskoka Lakes area, where my wife and I had a tourist resort, and got in what we call a Muskoka chair down by the lake and started reading it. And a couple of days later, my nephew came along and said, what are you reading? I told him, and he said, well, I'm a skeptic. I said, well, this is a free country still. I'm not sure it still is now, but it was then.
Right.
And, you're entitled to be a skeptic if you want to be.
Mm.
So he went home. A couple of days later, he phoned me, and he said, I was talking to the general, and the general says that every word of it is true and more. Well, in the meantime, I had finished the book, and I was convinced that it was real. The previous year, I had read an interesting fiction called The Life of Pi, and I think they're making a movie of it now, but it was a fascinating book, and I didn't know until, you know, the end whether it was fact or fiction. But with The Day After Roswell, I said to myself, is there any possibility that this could be fiction like The Life of Pi? And I came to the conclusion that it couldn't be, because I recognized the names of the generals and the Air Force bases and so on that were in the book. And this I remembered from my days as Minister of National Defense. So, strangely enough, just a week before that, I had been invited to speak at a symposium at the University of Toronto. We have a couple of ufologists here in Toronto called Mike Bird and Victor Vigianis. Vigiani, I guess it is. And they had invited me, and I had absolutely no intention of accepting the invitation because I'm not a ufologist. But when I got through reading the book, I said to myself, there are issues here that have to be discussed. It's important for the people of the world to know that these vehicles exist and that extraterrestrials have come to this planet, and that the United States Air Force and forces were making an effort to duplicate or replicate, to back engineers, the actual term that they use, the technology. And this has tremendous potential consequences, both for the United States and the people of the world. So I said, I'm afraid I'm going to have to speak up because I think this is very serious business, and the people have the right to know. And we can't have governments just hiding all the information and saying they know best, because from my own experience, I know that sometimes they do and usually they don't. So before I went public, though, I phoned the general because I had met him at an air show, and my nephew had given him a heads up that I would be calling. So I phoned him and said, and even before I could get my mouth open, he said, every word is true and more. And then he spent the next 20 minutes talking about the and more, which was really very fascinating. He went about as far as he could without breaking his oath, but he certainly confirmed not only that Roswell's book was authentic, but that there had in fact been face-to-face meetings between extraterrestrials and United States officials. So with this confirmation, I spoke out at the symposium and said that UFOs were as real as the airplanes flying overhead. And this, of course, was considered a breakthrough by the ufologists, because no one before that of cabinet rank from the G8 group of countries had ever gone public in such a definitive and unequivocal way. So that gives me the dubious distinction, I guess, of being the first person of cabinet rank in the G8 to go public. And, of course, as soon as I did that, then information started coming in from all over the world. I got dozens, probably hundreds, but certainly dozens and dozens of documents and books and all sorts of things. And I was inundated with books on the subject. And, of course, by then I was much more interested, so I spent a considerable amount of my time reading all of this information. Some of it was what you call chaff, I guess.
Right.
I soon got to be able to tell the difference between what was good and what was just, nonsense, and sifted it through. And I moved over a period of not too long from about kindergarten to maybe grade 3 or 4 in ufology. And I was briefed by some of the big names, Dr. Stephen Greer and Paul Harris, and just about everybody that you would see at a convention on ufology today, took me aside and gave me a few hours of their time to bring me up to date on the latest information that they had. So I certainly learned a lot, and I learned fast. And I don't say that I have a great knowledge of the subject, but I do say that it's tremendously, tremendously significant, and that it is a great, great crime that the United States government and other governments have not come clean in what they know, because they know a lot, and the United States government in particular, but also, I guess, the Russians and others, have back-engineered the technology to a very considerable extent. I would say to a mind-boggling extent. And it's really something that the people of the world are entitled to know about. So that's sort of where I am at the moment. And I'm still in favor of disclosure. I think the people are capable of taking it. And now in the United States, there are nearly more than half the people believe their government is lying to them on this subject. And there's just no excuse any longer, I don't think, of them keeping the whole subject under wraps. So I'm very much in favor of disclosure, both there and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I note with some interest that the United Kingdom and Canada and others have been making information public, but it's just sort of the fringe information. That's the, you know, about a few interesting sightings and the odd landing and this sort of thing, but without any significant detail about the technology or the species that have been visiting and so on.
But that's right. Now I want to get into why this is significant in your view, and what some of the components are to this when we talk about disclosure and what this could mean and everything else. But before we do that, there's a few more things I want to ask you. One of them is if you regret that you didn't look into the subject more at the time when you actually were in a potential position where you could have found more, found out more about the phenomena. I don't know if that ever was a possibility for you, Paul.
Decisions they made, if they had them to do over again. And I guess I was quite close to Robert McNamara in the United States, who was certainly in the loop, probably one of the few ministers of defense that was totally in the loop. And I think he would have shared the information with me or to a considerable extent, because he once told me, Paul, ask me anything you want to know and I'll tell you. And he was very blunt about it, but I didn't know what to ask. And so I didn't take advantage of that particular opportunity. As I said, really, I had what I thought were more important things on my mind at that particular time. But he was very open about it. And it would have been nice, but I've been trying to make up as best I can from the sources available today a lot of the information that I didn't get back then. Even then, it's very difficult to know what people will tell you, because you referred to shadow governments, and there's one in the United States, as you're well aware of. And they have information that they haven't shared with presidents. And some presidents have known a fair amount of what's going on, and most of them have not. They give them cursory briefings about this sort of thing, but they don't tell them about all the black operations that have been going on in Colorado and Arizona and New Mexico. They don't tell them the extent of the technology that they have back engineered, their capabilities at the present time, and so on this basis that somehow the permanent government, as Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's Magazine, puts it, they really run the show, and they consider that they own the country or own the world, and that politicians are just a nuisance that come along from time to time. You have to give them a little information to keep them quiet. But for heaven's sakes, don't tell them everything, because they'll go around blabbing. So that's sort of the situation, I think, in the United States. Bill Clinton, when asked directly at a press conference about the situation, was told the lady, very senior lady reporter, that there is a government in the United States other than the main government, and I don't control it. Well, that's a terrible admission for the commander-in-chief of the United States Armed Forces, that the armed forces actually have capabilities and weapons, some of them, in my opinion, diabolical weapons, that they have developed, and the President of the United States is not aware of them and hasn't been cut in on the secrets.
It's amazing a statement like that by Bill Clinton then doesn't spread farther and wider, if you will, and that many journalists don't pick up on that, because it's a big admission, isn't it?
Yes, I think I mentioned it in my book, Light at the End of the Tunnel. So anyone who wants to see the precise quote can get it from that.
That's right. Now, the black ops issue is a very interesting one. I want to get into the nature of some of this, and also the government and the shadow government, and who you perceive that is and who's in control of that. But what kind of technology do you think that they have today, if you would make a guess at this stage, I guess, because we don't have all the details and the facts, correct?
Well, my guess, based on information that I've been able to glean and a little bit of intuition, is that someone in the United States has already developed what you call exotic energy sources and is keeping it under the wraps. And by that, there are several, but the two that I specifically mentioned in my book that were given to me by one source are coal fusion and zero-point energy. And it is my belief that these have been developed to the point where they could be used or quickly developed for commercial purposes, and that they are really the only hope of the world. But Unfortunately, this shadow government is part of a wider group that I call, in my book, the Cabal. And the Cabal is comprises a very small group of people. The leaders of the banking industry worldwide, many of the same people who control the oil industry, and some very high-level people in the armed forces and industrial world. And they are sort of the outgrowth of a group that was called the MJ-12 when it was first launched many generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they're now a larger group. But they're the ones that seem to have access to the information as to what is going on and to what isn't. And as far as the energy is concerned, I suspect, and here I have no positive proof, and it's speculation on my part, I suspect that these exotic fuels are controlled by the same people who control the oil industry, the banking industry. And they have trillions of dollars in oil assets that they want to exploit and cash in on before they start coming clean on other forms of energy. And I look at that in bold terms. I can go back to my book for a minute, and one of the reasons that I'm so anxious to go to this conference, the Breakthrough Energy Conference in Holland, that's coming up in November, is because I think we've got about 10 years maximum to convert every car, truck, airplane, tractor, and household from fossil fuels to clean energy. And even that may be a little bit late, but at least it's about the best we could do. And we could do it now if we started and mobilize the same way that I saw the mobilization take place in World War II. All of the energy that was being put into domestic production of washing machines and cars and trucks and so on was diverted to war. Well, we have to convert just about everything we're doing in these areas into replacing fossil fuels with clean energy and spreading it around the world. And this means getting at it right away, making it public. And as far as the patents are concerned, the world should insist that they're made available at either free or very, very low cost to the underdeveloped world, because there's no point in having a few countries clean up their act unless the whole world does. That's not to say that it isn't worth one or two countries doing it, but it's saying if we're going to finish the job and make it work and stop global warming before it's too late, then it's got to be the universal mobilization, a universal attack on the use of fossil fuels that have been warming up the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, coming back to the Breakthrough Energy Convention in Holland, I hope that there will be some people speaking there who are knowledgeable about future energy sources. As you know, they're going to look at old forms of energy, present forms of energy, and then future forms of energy.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that they're going to have people speak who have had at least some either direct or indirect association with the kind of developments and technology that have actually taken place, and who are willing to blow the whistle on some of the members of the Cabal or it as a whole, and tell the world that there are things that can be done and that we should be getting on with it before it's too late.
What do you think would budge, as you call it, the Cabal, of heading in this direction, in your view? What's the reason for them to do doing this and heading in that direction? Because it seems they're not interested in that in the current state.
Well, in two words, greed and power. And a total callousness toward others and the future of the world. It's really tragic that people could be so self-centered, as you see some of the politicians and others being today, and certainly the members of the power group that are the puppeteers are in that category. And they're running the show. The politicians are just passing on the second and third hand information they get from their advisors. I'm terribly disappointed, for example, in the G20. The G20 had promise. It was given a big build up, as these things often are. Instead of having a G7, then a G8, you have a G20 and all of the leaders of the major countries of the world getting together to solve the problems of the world.
Yeah, right. Yep.
Well, in Toronto, all they did was cage us in like a bunch of monkeys for a few days. And I lived downtown, so I was, you know, directly there. I had to get a pass to get into my office on Sunday.
Yeah.
And then what do they talk about? They talk about saving the banking industry.
Yeah.
And that's about all they've been talking about ever since. And I said that in my book, and we'll say again, that whereas the number one problem in the world is global warming, the most urgent problem in the world, number two, is changing the banking and financial system. Because unless we do, nation states will not have the financial resources necessary to finance this very fast transition that I've been talking about. At the moment, and this applies to my country and to the United States and others, they're cutting back. They're repeating the mistakes of the 1930s. And instead of expanding, they're contracting the real economies to fit this artificial financial economy, which is exactly the wrong way to go. The European Union, for example, in its strictures that it put on Greece, has just reduced Greece's output, their GDP, has shrunk it up just to the point where it's, you know, crazy, absolute folly. And you've one more case of an International Monetary Fund recession, which have plagued the world for two or three decades now since Paul Volcker, when he was chairman of the Federal Reserve System in the United States, persuaded them to adopt a new role of being lifeguards to save the big giant banks and make them, as he called it, whole again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have a system that's all out of kilter, and the G20 get advised by bankers mostly. Their central bankers were all part of the international banking cabal, and they just can't seem to do anything about it.
All right, we have to switch over to the phones here, as we had some issues on the Skype line, as it were. But Paul is with us, and we're going to go ahead. Now, I wanted to ask you before we got cut off there, if you think that this potential new energy source and whatever this would actually be. It that depends, because we hear about many different ones, of course. But do you think that this could be something that would create a new industry, a whole bunch of new jobs, basically one that even could potentially revive the economy of sorts? What do you think, Paul?
Well, there's no doubt about it that the amount of work to be done would be enough to employ just about all the unemployed people in the world. So it would be a tremendous shot in the arm. But we have to change the system first, because under the present system, 95% of all money is created as debt by privately owned banks. And not only that, it's debt on which interest has to be paid. And so you have a situation where what we need now is a vast infusion of money into the system. But under the current rules, that can only be done by borrowing. So here we have a world where governments are in debt up to their ears, largely due to the actions of central banks in 1980-81 and again in 1991, and then the latest meltdown that was precipitated by Wall Street. We have governments up to their ears in debt and cutting back. And in Canada and until recently in the United States, individual households had debt equal to or greater than their net worth. And nobody has any money except a few industries who aren't going to spend it until they've got some customers, until there's someone out there with enough cash to buy their products. Our Minister of Finance recently and our central bank governor scolded industry for sitting on several billions of dollars of what they call dead money. Well, if they knew anything about business at all, they know that if you have enough or more capacity to meet the present demand, that you don't spend a lot of money creating greater demand until there's a greater demand for it. So the whole system now is depending on changing the system so that there is a lot of debt-free or at least interest-free money coming into the system to rejuvenate it, to get it back up to the kind of speed that we had during the early 2000s, and reemploying half or more of all the unemployed people in the world. And what that requires, in my opinion, is a massive infusion of government-created money. And there's a big difference between government-created money and bank-created money, potentially, at least. Governments own the patent to create money. They own the right to create money. Banks have no rights. All they have are the rights that have been granted to them by legislatures, parliaments, congresses. That's where they get their authority. But they got it from the legislatures who can either take it away from them or modify it. And what I've been calling for worldwide is a massive infusion of, say, $10 trillion of government-created money, which has no strings attached to it, that's spent into circulation in order to revive the economies and get things up and running so that not only are people working, but that we would have the financial capability of then transforming the world on the energy front. So the whole thing is tied together.
Mm-hmm.
And whether $10 trillion would do it or not, I don't know. In the United States, I would say they need more than $1 trillion right now. They're in the slump. And they're talking about cutting back, raising taxes and cutting back next January after the turn of the year. And it's just exactly the wrong way to go. And certain, some of the people down there, including the congressional budgetary people, are saying this could tip them into another recession instead of going the other way and going towards prosperity. So what they have to do is the same thing that, and there are various ways of doing it. I mean, it's not limited to just one way, but they have to do the equivalent of what Abraham Lincoln did. And that is to print a lot of greenbacks and get them out into circulation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, of course, the knee-jerk reaction of all the bankers and the economists is, well, that would be inflationary. Well, the Federal Reserve System has created several $1 trillion, what they call a quantitative easing, in the last 2 or 3 years. And it's all gone into the hands of the bank, and it hasn't been the least bit inflationary, because it isn't getting into the public sphere, you know, where people can spend it, and where businesses are competing for labor instead of picking and choosing and driving wages down because there are so many unemployed people. And we've got to rebalance the system, and not just temporarily, but permanently. And in my book and in the other book I mentioned to you, A Miracle in Waiting, I say that governments should create 34% of the money that is created every year, instead of less than 5% as they're doing now. And it should be created debt-free so that the people don't have to pay interest on it forever, which is what they have to do if they borrow it from the banks. And that's the reason the whole system is ground to a halt. And it means, of course, bringing bank leverages down very substantially from what they have been, because they've been very high. If I could just spend a minute or two on bank leverages, if you go back to the time when the Bank of England was chartered, King William had been fighting a war in Europe and ran out of money, so somebody said, well, why don't you start a bank? Sounded like a good idea, so he did. And the rich people of London put up £1,200,000 in silver and gold and lent it all to the king, to the government, at 8%, which is a pretty high interest rate for a government-guaranteed loan. And they had some little charges that they threw in, too. Well, then to show his appreciation, the king said, you can now print, P-R-I-N-T, £1,200,000 in banknotes and lend them to your rich friends as well. So, in effect, they were lending the same money twice,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and getting interest once from the king and once from the people.
Yeah.
Well, over the years, that ratio, which was 2-1 at that time, has become insanely more generous. And in the early days of the 20th century in the United States, federally chartered banks had to have a gold reserve of 25%, which meant that they could lend the same capital four times. In Canada, when I was younger, and right up until 1991, the banks had to have a cash reserve, and usually it was 8%, which meant that they could lend the same money 12.5 times. Well, then in 1991, we did what Milton Friedman had sort of led them to think they could do, is put in a deregulated system where the banks could have assets equal to 20 times their capital, which means that they were lending the same money 20 times to 20 different people or organizations or governments and collecting interest from every one of the 20. And in a speech that I made in Arizona a year ago, February, I said, that is total fraud. You and I can't lend the same money to three or four people and get interest back from each of them, or we'd go to jail. And the only reason the bankers don't is because they have this special privilege, this license to print money. And so I'm saying that the governments should print a third of it, and the banks be reduced to two-thirds, and that would mean reducing their leverage back to about 2-1, depending on how you reckon it, from 20-1, which it was at the time that they were allowed to, or that they were able to crash the system the way they did in New York in 2007-2008. So until we do that, there's not going to be, well, I don't say peace on earth, but there's not going to be opportunity for ordinary people, because we're just going to go further and further into debt, be paying a larger and larger proportion of our salaries in interest on debt, both personal and government, and there's no money left for this transition that we were talking about of going from fossil fuels to clean energy.
Yeah,
because that requires trillions of dollars, which at this moment we do not have. And the only way we could get is to borrow, and there's no incentive to borrow. So we've got to change the system, or the game is going to be lost.
And as long as they're in control of the system, own it, operate it, then again, they don't have any incentive. They don't want to change anything because they don't want to give up the power that they have. And so with that in mind, to be able to break the status quo, that you know, the deadlock we're in right now, something obviously have to change first.
But this requires congressmen with enough guts to vote in favor of the people instead of thinking of nothing but how much of campaign funds that we're going to get from the banks in the next election.
Well, exactly, and that was one of the points I want to bring up, because it doesn't seem to matter how much people demand or how you know loud they scream, because again, if the banker prints the money and they put the people in charge that are going to make the laws that are going to be beneficial to them, so it's like it's a deadlock.
That's very true. You're right, dead on, and that's unfortunately what happened to President Obama. He got the same gang around him. that had been in and out of the Treasury and
he was groomed from day one.
The other party, and they just go around in circles, causing the same kind of trouble to whoever's there.
Yeah. So what's your suggestion there? What do you think? What has to give away for this to begin to gain some momentum of at least getting some honesty back into the system, if you know what I mean?
Well, it means really the sort of instead of the Occupy Wall Street, that there's an Occupy something that's big enough to scare the pants off politicians if they don't do something. And it's got to be massive. It can happen. It has happened. But one of the problems, I think, is lack of information that the young people that were so dedicated in their efforts to draw attention to the fact that 1% of the people in the world are living off the fat of the land and the rest are struggling, didn't really understand what they wanted, didn't know what they should be asking for. And so I'm saying it would be nice if they could get their act together, learn how the system works, and just present a proposal to government and say, this is it. I wrote one for our country and tried to get it looked at and sent copies to the members of parliament and the senators, suggesting that the government of Canada print 15 share certificates in Canada of a nominal value of $10 billion each, and then present them to the Bank of Canada, changing the Bank Act if necessary, but I don't think it would really be necessary, in exchange for $150 billion cash. And then split that with the provinces, who would then share with the municipalities. But every level of government would have enough cash to not only operate the way they are and have been, but to take on some new initiatives, like replacing infrastructure, old water mains that are rotten and breaking up all winter, and bridges that are ready to fall down, and all that sort of thing. And there are all kinds of things to do, not to mention the energy thing, which is the big one. And so this is perfectly feasible, and under our system in Canada, where the government controls both the House and the Senate, they could put it into operation in 2 weeks. Yeah. And the fact that they're not is really a tragedy of major proportions. But they're under the control of the system, and the economists in the government, there are a few that have studied economics, including the Prime Minister, were obviously trained by the same kind of economists that I was, who really haven't graduated from the Flat Earth Society yet.
Now, okay, this might be a tricky question here, but if we think about this, with all the talk of global warming, I never hear any discussions following on from that debate when it comes to looking into new energy sources. And I'm not talking about solar and wind and all that. I'm talking about like the real good stuff that you mentioned here a while back.
Right.
And the question is, do you think that they have to look into the UFO subject to get their eyes to open to new possibilities? Because, again, it seems like it's equally part of the imagination of mankind collectively right now, that it's like there's nothing new on the horizon, if you know what I mean.
Well, I think they have to find out where the information is and go after it. And I think they already have it. And it's just a question of making it public. But if not, I know some people like Carol Rosen. I don't know if you're familiar with that name
or
not.
Sure, yeah, I am, yeah.
But Carol is somebody who is a contactee, and she has been told, in effect, that if we put our treaty into effect so that we're not going to shoot at the visitors if they come down and help us, and if we don't put off any more thermonuclear bombs, that they will give us the technology. So that I'm not the least bit concerned that it's there or can be there. What I'm concerned about is the will of politicians to start being concerned about the future of the world and its people, because first we're affected by these terrible floods that we're getting now every year, and I just came back from a wonderful cruise from Alaska down to Vancouver. Saw all those great glaciers, and nearly every one of them was retreating. There were only one or two that were still live, and they're retreating. And this spells disaster if we just let it continue and let the polar ice cap melt and flood the coastal areas of half the world and put some of the Pacific islands and nations underwater.
Now, in a little bit here, we're going to begin to wrap things up here for the first segment, Paul. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit more about your books. And again, I want to give out all the details about the conference. In Holland, you've mentioned two titles, Light at the End of the Tunnel, that's your latest one, and then also Miracle in Waiting about the economy.
A miracle in waiting, yes. So economics that makes sense.
Absolutely. Now, give us your website so people know where to go to find out more about these the titles here.
Yeah, it's. I think I'll better check it here. I think it's paulheatherweb.net, but I don't want to make a mistake because I haven't used it for a long while.
I have the .com here, so I think that's the right one. paulheatherweb.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, probably.
Yeah.
Let's say that that's right because if somebody gave it to you, that's probably the right one.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, on the site right now, so it's paulheatherweb.com, and that's where you can... You have in the menu more about the books right up there. And also, of course, then the upcoming conference here in Holland. It's the full title of that is called the Breakthrough Energy Movement. And it's going to be at...
BEM, yeah.
Yeah, BEM. It's going to be at Hilversum in Holland. And the website for that is simply globalem.com. And we're going to have both of these websites up there, of course. But what are some of the things you're going to talk about when you're in Holland here in November? And by the way, the date there is 9th to the 11th, by the way. But what are you going to focus on, Paul?
Basically a State of the Union address for the world.
All right, really good. And have you been to Holland before, by the way?
To Holland? Oh, yes.
Yeah, many times, maybe.
Well, several times when,
yeah.
When I was Minister of Defense and used to... visit around, and I was after I was Minister of Defense once as a journalist when there were some exercises being taking place there.
Right, really good. Globalem.com, take a look. There's a lot of other speakers there as well for you to check out, and they're going to be there in Holland on the 9th to the 11th, and our friend Jeroen from Holland is putting that on, and he was, of course, in charge of the secret space program last year in 2011, where we were to shoot our TV episode about the secret space program as well. So it's really good stuff. Check that out. And again, then the website for Paul Hellier is simply paulhellierweb.com, where you can go to read more about the titles here, Light at the End of the Tunnel and Miracle in Waiting. Well, I think we should round things up here for the first segment then, Paul. And so thank you for that. Have a great day, and we'll talk later.
You too. Thanks, Bob.
That's our program for today. Red Ice Radio will be back in just a few days with Barbara Oakley on pathological altruism. Full list of upcoming guests in our radio archive at redicecreations.com. Check out our new website, redicemembers.com. There you will also find details about all our past programs going back to 2006, opinions and research on a wide variety of topics. Thank you for listening and for staying with us. Take good care, and we'll talk to you soon.